you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Rossiter against Goldberg. Mr. Solicitor General.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case presents the question whether the Military Selective Service Act, by providing for a male-only registration and classification for possible induction into the armed services, violates the equal protection component of the Fifth Amendment by invidiously discriminating against men. This is an appeal from the judgment of a three-judge court determining that the male-only registration provision of the Military Selective Service Act offends the Constitution and enjoining proceedings pursuant to that act. There is no substantial dispute about the facts giving rise to this controversy. Since 1948, the Military Selective Service Act has provided for the registration of males between the ages of 18 and 26 and their classification and induction into the armed services.
Do all males in that age group have to register?
All male citizens and all male resident aliens. Only aliens not in non-immigrant status are required.
But all males, including ministers and...
All of them register, Mr. Justice Stewart. The classification system provides for exemptions and deferments.
Right.
This condition continued until 1973, when the Congress decided to experiment with an all-volunteer army, and the conscription provision of the statute was removed. However, the registration and classification provisions continued, as they do today, in effect. But in 1975, the President decided to discontinue the classification of persons under the Military Selective Service Act. And this was the condition until 1980, when the President of the United States sent a message to the Congress indicating his desire, because of foreign policy and military exigencies, to reactivate the registration procedure, and he also requested them to extend the scope of the requirement for registration and classification to include females. The three-judge case, which was...
May I ask, Mr. Solicitor General, is the registration statute explicit as to the permissible uses of the registration lists?
It is not.
I mean, it doesn't
forbid the list for any purposes other than the stated purposes, but it states the purpose for which it would be used.
Well, what I'm getting at, of course, is may the registration list be used, for example, to staff non-military jobs?
It may.
What I'm thinking about is during the war, you recall, not we but our allies had all kinds of registration lists, which they then used to bring women into war industries.
If you're inquiring for service other than within the armed services,
yes.
My understanding is that it does not.
It does not.
It's for induction into the military services. It's not a universal service act, as I understand it.
Except, I suppose, people who in certain classifications might be assigned outside the military.
That was certainly done under the Act, and I assume it was done lawfully. Non-combatant service within the service and other service related to the national welfare, I think, was the rubric that was used during World War II, the Korean War, and the Southeast Asian hostilities. The President requested the Congress to shift funds from the Department of Defense to the inactive selective service machinery to reactivate it, to commence the registration of males and females, as he requested, under this message that he sent. The Congress considered the message and by joint resolution transferred funds from the Department of the Defense to the Selective Service Agency to permit it to function, but denied the request to expand the Selective Service requirement to have women register. The three-judge case, which had been commenced earlier in Philadelphia, was then reactivated, and the court determined that by reason of the non-inclusion of women, that there was an invidious discrimination against males, that the statute was unconstitutional because it offended the Fifth Amendment, and it enjoined further classification.
Mr. Solicitor General, you've used the term reactivated. When that original action in three-judge district court was brought in, 71, was it? 1971.
Was
the statute we're now concerned with in the pleadings?
The statute was still in effect, but in 1975, the President discontinued registration under the statute. So the statute still authorized the President by proclamation to reinstitute a registration.
So you have no problem about the action being a proper vehicle for the issues that are now here?
We did not raise this in our jurisdictional statement. We don't raise it now. We believe the matter is properly before the court, and we certainly would rather have the court adjudicate it now than to wait until a genuine emergency with an injunction preventing the President to act in the best interest of the country.
Well, General McCree, may I ask, is the statute one that simply authorizes the President to by proclamation to require registration, or that it directs him to?
It authorizes him by proclamation.
And then after this 1980 action in Congress, he did issue a proclamation.
He did issue a proclamation requiring young men who were born in 1960 and 1961 to register, and then on a continuing basis, persons who were born after January 1st, 1963, on or before the 30 days prior to their 18th birthday. And that is continuing now under a stay granted by this court following our appeal from the determination of unconstitutionality.
General McCree, I might have missed it. Have these pleadings been amended?
Were they amended in the court below,
yes, sir.
Mr. Justice? Yes, the pleadings were, and parties were added because some of the original parties were beyond the registration limit at that time, the 26 age. The persons were added so that there was an appropriate class of persons who were subject to the requirement of registration.
Is it now aimed at the new statute or the old?
It is aimed at the old statute because the statute wasn't changed to require the registration of women. And it's still a male-only registration statute.
And that's what's before us.
That's what's before the court at this time, if the court please.
Mr. Solicitor General, when we began interrupting you with our questions, and I'm now continuing the interruption, you stated that the three-judge district court held that this statute was constitutionally invalid because it invidiously discriminated against men.
Against men.
That's clear, is it?
That's clear. It was a determination of and in fact, a challenge was not made that it invidiously discriminated against women. Mm-hmm. Other grounds were asserted that the court didn't pass on. They asserted that it took property without due process of law, that it violated the prohibition against involuntary servitude. But those contentions were found to be insufficient, and only on the invidious discrimination against males was the statute held invalid. The court below employed what this court has called in some of its decisions an intermediate level of scrutiny that required that the draft registration be substantially related to an important governmental objective. And the court below determined that the findings of the Congress on the question of military need did not show an important governmental objective or substantial relation thereto, and made a very extended examination of what it regarded the showing that the government had made. We contend essentially two things here. First, we assert that because this case arises in the context of a power expressly granted to the Congress by the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, to raise an army, that the court should apply the rational relationship standard in determining this validity. We submit that raising an army and conducting war is sui generis.
Mr. Solicitor General, would you take that position if the classification was one that was racially discriminatory? Based on the authority to raise.
I think we might do that, but we would say that.
If said, would have registered only Negroes and no whites.
But we would say that that could not be rationally related to an important governmental objective. Because.
Well, I thought a rational basis test doesn't talk about important governmental objective. Legitimate, doesn't it?
A rational relationship to a legitimate, the court is correct, a legitimate governmental objective.
And you say that would not be legitimate.
And we would say that would not be a legitimate governmental.
Gender-based discrimination could be supported as related to a legitimate government.
We submit that it would in this
racial.
Case, and
how
not
about,
racial.
How about religious?
And
only
not
Jews
religious.
Shall be registered.
And not religious. We not say religious. That it would not be a legitimate governmental objective.
Only gender-based, sex.
We believe gender-based is related to a legitimate governmental relationship for the reason that...
And you don't have to say that only gender-based.
No, not only gender-based, but we just say the gender-based would satisfy
well,
that
what I'm
test.
Thinking of, other bases, race, religion...
Well, I think I follow the court's question.
We've always talked about something more than the rational basis.
Well, I would look at the court's question this way. Historically, and in the interpretations by this court, race is no longer an appropriate classification for the disparate treatment of anybody in this country anymore. And I think, if I can say anything that I believe categorically, that's it.
Because it's always irrational.
Correct. It's always irrational.
So no matter what test you apply, it will always fall.
And so it wouldn't pass the first level of scrutiny.
Correct.
But we think that this matter should be determined in the first level of scrutiny, as I suggested, because of the sui generis nature of raising an army to prepare for war. The Congress is full of references to this. Of course, Article 1, Section 8 specifically empowers the Congress to raise armies, to wage war and make rules for that.
I take it what you said earlier about always irrationality in case of racial discrimination. You're suggesting then Karametsu has been overruled?
I would think this court would decide Karametsu differently today.
Karametsu was decided at a time when it had not been held that the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment incorporated anything, any, the standards of equal protection. That was first held in Bowling against Sharp, if I'm not mistaken, and Korematsu antedated that decision.
Well, Korematsu certainly did. Hirabashu, was that the other, that was
the other one.
The other one that was decided with it. And I would say that even viewing the equal protection component of the Fifth Amendment, as the Court would now is applying, it would decide Korematsu differently.
Well, there's a certain truth to the saying that civil liberties get their greatest protection after the war is over, isn't it?
I certainly can't quarrel with that assertion. But we think that the fact that the Congress has told the Constitution tells the Congress, you raise the armies, you make rules for their governance, vests in them an authority that tells the courts that this is something that you should approach with great deference to the congressional primacy in this area. There are many other areas in the Constitution, as the Court is well aware, that point up this special circumstance. The writ of habeas corpus, for example, can be suspended in time of invasion. And the Ninth Circuit did uphold a suspension of the writ of habeas corpus in World War II, although there had not been a physical invasion of the Hawaiian Islands. This Court denied certiorari in this case. But it's some evidence of what the Constitution intended, the relationship of the Court and the Congress and the executive branch to be in this extraordinary circumstance of waging war or preparing to wage war.
Well, is there anything in Article 1, Section 8 that limits the power of Congress to raise and maintain armies in time of war?
No, there is no limitation.
It's
an authorization just to raise and maintain armies and naval forces in time. It doesn't restrict it to time of war at all. And it tells, as we respectfully submit, it tells the courts that this is a matter where great deference should be paid to the congressional determination. And the Congress determined in this case that in the event of a mobilization, what would be necessary would be raising an effective army expeditiously. And to do this, it would require flexibility. And the flexibility that it would be afforded, as the record clearly establishes, is to have persons who could perform competent as well as non-competent roles in the armed services.
Well, Mr. Solicitor General, there wasn't any evidence, or was there? Was there any evidence before the Congress that registration of women would negatively affect the military capacity?
There is yes, if the Court please. There is evidence before the Court that although women can perform and have performed and still do perform effectively and with great credit in non-combatant roles, that they are not eligible by statute and policy for certain roles in actual close combat.
Well,
and that
does that add up to evidence that registration of women who surely are being used and could be used in other capacities in combat, does that add up to any evidence that
registration of
women in and of itself would negatively affect?
No, I think it does, because at this time, at the time of mobilization, what would be necessary would be persons who could be rotated among all of the military roles that might be required. And although the women could perform and do perform and have performed efficiently in the non-combatant roles, they couldn't be rotated. And flexibility is what is needed initially at the time of mobilization. There is evidence that through volunteer activity, it is anticipated that a sufficient number of women would be available in the event of the mobilization that was projected by the armed services witnesses who testified here.
General McCree, am I right in my assumption that no one challenges the statutory provision that women shall not be sent into combat?
No one challenges it in this litigation.
I beg your pardon. I suppose you could concede that this was an unwise statute, that Congress made the wrong decision in the whole circumstance, but that doesn't make it unconstitutional. Is that?
Well, I would certainly assert that. I think if we defer to the Congress, it really means that we defer to their right to be wrong. If we just defer to them when we're right, it's not really deferring.
Getting back to this other point about combat, assuming that women are now on the training list for astronauts, couldn't they drive an airplane?
Well, I don't think
in
there's
combat,
any.
In combat.
I don't think there's any question about that. But the Congress, by statute, has provided that women are not eligible to perform certain functions, and the Army has policies that they shall not, too. Now, the fact that a person can pilot an airplane, can even function as a crew of an, and some men who cannot, the Congress can make this kind of determination if it's something that's peculiarly committed to them, and the military people will do it too. The problem really.
Mr. Solicitor, how did Congress make that decision? Currently. Did they? Perhaps they did when they passed the law originally. They refused to change it.
The Congress refused to change
and
it.
Which would have taken legislation?
Which would have taken legislation.
Well, was there a proposal that failed to come out of committee or was voted down on the floor?
There were proposals in both houses, and on pages 29 and 31 through 31 of the government's brief, we set forth in the margin the committee action where this was considered fully. And
well, did it ever get on the floor? Was it ever voted down, actually, or was it just a committee failing to report it?
I believe it was a committee failing to report it out, but I
so there aren't,
like
there
to
aren't,
refer to this.
There are not so-called congressional findings.
This was before the Congress, and the Congress did enact a joint resolution shifting funds.
Yes.
Which means that they considered this.
Yes, they shifted funds for the registration of males. But there's nothing in that resolution which indicates what Congress thought about these factors.
Mr. McCree?
Yes.
Mr. Solicitor General? Yes. May I call your attention to the fact that the conference report explicitly approved the findings by the Senate Armed Services Committee. On page 100 of the conference report on the Defense Department Authorization Act.
I appreciate that reference, and I would suggest, too, that Senate Report number 96-826 on page 159 also adopts the conference also adopts the committee report and makes
the conference report was adopted by both houses.
And makes by both houses. And it makes this specific finding that there is no established military need to include women in a selective service system. Now, we don't contend, in further response to Mr. Justice Marshall, that women cannot perform a wide variety of roles. But the military has made this determination, and the Congress has made this determination, and would be against the law to employ them in certain kinds of military activity at this time.
Mr. Solicitor General, is it not true that your entire argument assumes that that decision is a constitutional decision to keep
assumes,
them out of combat?
You mean assumes the validity of the statute
yes.
that excludes them from this purpose?
Yes.
It does, but that's not under attack. No one has attacked this statute. No one has attacked these policies. And we submit further that we should defer, the court should defer to the determination of the military in a matter as vital as this at this time. Now, it may be that they'll extend the selective service at another time when it appears that it would be militarily sound to do this.
Well, did the military testify against the registration of women?
The military initially supported the registration of women.
Yes, registration.
But at the same time testified that they would not be inducted.
Well, yes, but the
for the purpose of mobilization.
But the question is registration here, isn't it?
Mr. Justice White, the question is registration, but registration can't be divorced from classification and induction because they're registered.
Well, the people who testified must have thought they could be separated because they testified in favor of registration.
But they also testified against induction.
And so they can be separated.
Well, they can for the purpose of symbolism.
Well,
but people are registered in order to establish an eligible pool of persons who can be inducted.
Do we judge this case on the basis that registration means mobilization of women, or that it just means registration?
Well, I just think the court cannot divorce from its consideration of registration the purpose for which it's done.
Well, I know, but Mr.
I think it would be an arbitrary act to register.
The same committee report, if I recall, of the armed services in any event, also made a finding, didn't it, that there were grave shortages also exist for Army surgeons and nurses? And might not induction be limited to registrants, women registrants, for jobs like that?
Well, there, yes, if the court please, but their needs at this time for mobilization are for persons who would afford them the maximum flexibility, who even put in a nursing situation initially could be used for a close combat situation if required. And they anticipated...
How much of that was done in Vietnam? What percentage? Do we have any statistic of,
I can't justify,
of what the percentage was of those who went to Vietnam ever actually saw combat?
I can't testify about Vietnam. I know something about World War II. And I know that the attrition was always at the front. You might have, say, 100% of your personnel, and 90% may be support, and 10% is actively engaged. But your turnover is in the 10%. And then you have to have the flexibility to move other people in there in times of emergency, as, for example, the Battle of the Bulge at the Ardennes, where cooks, bakers, everybody who could carry a rifle was pressed into service. Those are roles forbidden today by statute and policy from women, and the testimony here for women to perform. And the testimony here is that the initial needs at mobilization would be for persons who could be rotated into any situation where there may be a military need. And all we are arguing here is that the all-male registration at this time
Didn't the director of Selective Service testify here that if we had to mount an effort in Europe, we'd need 650,000 males and 80,000 women?
That's my those are the figures that I recall.
Well, wasn't that in support of the idea that we ought to register women so that
we
could get that 80,000 even in a period of mobilization?
He thought the 80,000 women would be furnished by volunteer.
Didn't Admiral Hayward and General Wilson both testify to that effect?
This was their experience in the light of females volunteering for the service.
Well, you said that initially military people testified in favor of, Defense Department representatives testified in favor of registering women. Did they change their mind, or was that their consistent position?
The Congress decided against them. They did not. No, they did not change their mind.
So from a military standpoint, there was not only no objection to registering women, but they supported it.
Except their testimony has to be understood in the light of their further testimony that even if we registered them, we would not induct them.
I understand, but nevertheless, Congress overruled them.
And the Congress, to which the Constitution
right.
gave the authority to raise an army, right. decided in the light of the testimony that they would like to register women, but they would not induct them, mm-hmm. decided not to provide for the registration of women at this time.
There's nothing unusual about the Congress not agreeing with the executive branch on a particular issue, is there?
Not in my experience, Mr. Chief Justice.
Mr. Solicitor General, if we don't agree with you that the rationality test it's applicable here, but some heightened tests like Craig and Boren, your time's running out. What have you to say to that if we disagree with you and say that it has to be the heightened?
We believe that we satisfy Craig versus Boren. We believe here that this is an important governmental objective to raise an army, and we believe that registration is substantially related to it, and registration of men is, in the light of the testimony.
When you say substantially related, is that because there's some finding that women are not needed in the military, or must there be some burden that the registration of women would affirmatively cause some kind of problem?
Oh, I don't think there must be a showing that women would cause some kind of problem. I think we have to show...
Well, then would you have to show that under the heightened scrutiny, would you at least have to show that women are not needed in the military?
I don't even think we'd have to show that women are not needed. I think we'd have to show that to adopt this policy would create a greater likelihood of achieving the important objective than the rational level case is that it would be somehow related to achieving.
Well, wouldn't an adequate answer to Justice Brennan's question be that you need them in the military, but you don't need to register them?
I appreciate that answer, that suggestion,
well,
and I adopt
supported,
that.
That was supported, I repeat, by the testimony of Admiral Hayward and General Wilson, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, that they could get all they needed on volunteer service.
Just one other thought, if I may have just one moment. The Congress may also have determined that to process women registrants at this time, since we're talking about 51% of the population, they'd need to allocate twice as many resources just to the registration and classification. And if they're not going to induct it this time.
Isn't that just an argument of administrative convenience?
Well, I think it's more than that. It's an argument of talking about finite resources and how they should be allocated. I see my time has expired. Thank you.
Mr. Weinberg.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I think there are four propositions, none of which is seriously disputed in this case, which place into perspective just what is and what is not at issue in this case. And I think these are four points of reference of which we ought not lose sight. First, registering women for the draft does not dictate any number of women who will be drafted, nor the roles which they would fill if they were drafted. Instead, registration of women opens the possibility of drafting women to fill the very positions which they may now or in the future serve as volunteers if there is not an adequate rate of volunteers for those positions.
May I interrupt you at this point and ask, is it not possible that your next suit, if you win this one, and if women were not drafted on an equal basis with men, would not the same men who are complaining here today bring a suit on that basis? If not, why?
Well, I don't think that that would be the case. One of the issues that the district court specifically said was not before it and would, in fact, be inconsistent with its rationale and the rationale of this suit is...
Inconsistent in what way?
Inconsistent in that the theory of this suit and the theory of the district court was that you register people as an inventory.
You register them equally.
Register equally as insurance against an unpredictable future. We don't know what needs are going to eventuate. We don't know what the assignment policies are going to be when they do.
That what interest do your clients have in having women registered if they're none of them going to be drafted? I see they have no interest whatsoever in just pure registration.
Well, I don't think that that's true that we can say that none will be drafted. The important point is we don't know who will be drafted.
But you must assume that some of them will be drafted or there's nothing worth fighting about.
It is safe to assume, I think, that over...
And therefore, there is a connection between registration and drafting. So your first proposition is wrong.
No, Your Honor, I have to disagree with that. There is, of course, a connection between registration and drafting. But what's important is that the connection is not that we draft everyone we register or that we draft randomly from the registrants.
Do you concede that the government may draft in unequal numbers, that they could set quotas of 75% of the draftees will be male and 25% will be female? Do you concede that?
I would embrace the point that the military needs at the time that mobilization is necessary ought to dictate the proportion in which men or women are drafted.
And do you concede that there are different military needs for men and for women?
There may be at a given time.
But today, you need 650,000 men and 80,000 women. Is that a legitimate constitutional difference in need?
It would support a differential induction. It would not support a differential registration.
But you would concede that a differential induction would be constitutionally permissible?
Yes, based upon military need.
Mr. Weinberg, if you continue to prevail in this case, does that mean that every past registration and conscription act of this country is unconstitutional?
I don't believe that that would be the case. Questions of constitutionality and retroactivity would, I think, generally be resolved against the retroactivity of a decision in a case like this. I would note that both the factual setting and the legal standard have been developing over time, and I don't see the kinds of clear signposts to retroactivity that are usually associated with rendering a finding of unconstitutionality to be retroactive.
How about the Veterans Preference Act?
Pardon?
How about Veterans Preference Acts dating from previous draft acts?
I think that the court decided that in Feeney, and noting in Feeney that the result of the Veterans Preference winds up disproportionately favoring men was a function of the service, which incidentally was a result of the inequality of conscription, among other things. I don't think that that would require the voiding of any veterans' preference statutes, because the fact is still that the people served and earned their veterans' preference as opposed to being registered to serve. And I think that, again, we come to the question, we can no more say who would have been drafted than we can say who will be drafted. And it's particularly that prospective uncertainty that we don't know today what the military needs will be if and when we ever have to draft, that is really the distinction between registration on the one hand and conscription on the other.
Mr. Weinberg, up to now, your arguments, at least as I follow it, is that there were better ways to do it than Congress did. There were more logical ways. But does that make it, the failure to do that, does that make it unconstitutional?
Well, we go well beyond saying...
You haven't got that far yet.
That's true, Your Honor. We do go well beyond saying that what Congress did was merely illogical. It was, in fact, directly contrary to the ostensible purpose and the declared purpose of the statute. And for that reason, I think it would even be fairly characterized as not having any rational relationship to a legitimate, articulated, or obvious governmental interest.
You don't challenge the statute that prohibits the use of women in certain combat positions?
With all due respect, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, we deny the existence of such a statute with respect to the Army. There is none. With respect to the Navy, there is no, no statute barring women from combat, merely from assignment to ships or airplanes with combat missions. For example, in the Navy, women are eligible for assignment to the SEALs, which is the Navy's version of the Green Beret Special Forces.
Well,
would
a decision in your favor here have any effect on the Navy policy?
You mean the statute?
Right.
It would not directly implicate that statute. I would point out that for now several years, both the Air Force and the Navy, which are the only two services subject to such statutes, have been requesting the repeal of such statutes on grounds having absolutely nothing to do with registration or the draft, but merely having to do with their own military management. And what we're really talking about is, I think, the Army situation, where the Army now has the right to decide assignment questions according to its own lights, according to its own perceived needs. And I think this is one of the things which distinguishes particularly Admiral Hayward's testimony, because he was, when he said, we will be able to fill it, he was talking about the Navy, and the naval requirement for women is very small because the freedom of assignment in the Navy is very small. In the Army, it's a very different case.
But you don't challenge here the freedom of assignment in the, or rather the limitation of freedom of assignment in the Navy or the Air Force.
This case does not raise that.
And you don't challenge it, I did.
No, it's irrelevant to the decision of this case.
Well, we judge this case on the assumption that that is valid.
That is correct. Indeed, one of the most important points that I would hope to make is that the district court assumed the continuing applicability of all current limitations in all services on numbers and assignments of women, and still found as a fact that all-male registration did not enhance military flexibility or the ability of the nation to respond to the full range of possible futures which might confront us. More importantly, in fact, it found that the exclusion of women from registration undermined military flexibility, and that is a finding of fact which has not been attacked here as clearly erroneous. And on the record, I submit, could not be attacked as clearly erroneous.
The district court's analysis course was in the context of the heightened scrutiny test, the Craig Boren test.
Yes, Your Honor.
Suppose we don't agree that was correct. What have you to say to the government's argument that in any event, what ought to be applied here is the rational basis test, and by any measure that test is satisfied?
Well, the finding of fact that military flexibility is in fact undermined by exclusion does not depend upon what test is used in the analysis. That's a finding of fact that was based directly on the testimony of the military. And I would only comment here what the testimony of all of the Joint Chiefs was, and that was we should register.
This go to, the legitimacy of the government interest? What?
Pardon?
What does it go to, the legitimacy of the governmental interest?
No, Your Honor. We certainly would concede the legitimacy of the governmental interest in raising an adequate armed force. That is indeed the statutory purpose. What it would go to is the rational relationship, or on a heightened scrutiny basis, the substantial and close relationship to that interest. And in fact, the finding of fact here, supported by an overwhelming record, is that the exclusion of women from registration, which means excluding them from the pool of people to whom we can turn in time of war, in time of emergency, for the skills that we know they do possess, and the very skills that we have sought to bring into the armed forces by increasing the female volunteer rate and the level of volunteer soldiers, we would exclude ourselves from being able to turn to those. And the district court found, and I submit correctly, certainly not clearly erroneously, that objective is undermined by excluding women from the registration pool.
Wouldn't that objective be equally undermined by excluding everybody under 18 and everybody over 26?
I think not. We again have a great body of...
That includes an awful lot of people with a lot of different and varied experiences.
Yes, it does.
But the art that the military could well use, I suppose.
And under certain circumstances, eligibility for induction continues well past age 26. The important thing is, here we focus on registration.
You did not attack the constitutional validity of the statute based upon its discrimination in favor of everybody in this country under 18 years of age and everybody in this country over 26 years.
No, Your Honor, for two reasons. I don't think an age discrimination case would have been appropriate. First, the age discrimination standard is clearly the lower standard. And more importantly, there are a great number of reasons consistent with the statute, particularly the maintenance of a strong economy and a minimized and equitable, fair, fairly minimized disruption of life that would be supported by limiting the exposure. And here again, we're talking exposure of induction.
We're only talking about registration.
And that's what I'm saying, that
Justice
we're going here.
Suggests you might as well register everybody over 26, and you have much larger pool to draw from. And there are a lot of retirees, for example, who can perform non-combatant service very, very well.
And a lot of former servicemen. Most of the former servicemen are over 26.
To the extent that, they generally have continued service obligations, and so are within the reach of the statute.
Well, that's not necessarily true at all. When you're mustered out, you're generally given the option whether to remain in the reserve or not. And I, at least speaking from my only experience in the Second World War, I opted for the, just getting out.
How do you distinguish the policy question involved in fixing the ages and the policy question made at this stage for limited purposes of excluding women?
Well,
aren't they equally policy decisions by Congress, whether wise or unwise?
Well, to start with, the policy decision to exclude women, which was made in 1948, was not a considered decision at all. There was a good deal of testimony as to what a suitable age for exposure to service would be. There was no such consideration of including or excluding women. Using traditional statutory interpretation methods, the contemporaneous statutory history of acts before the same committees, the same Congress, at the same time, the Women's Armed Service Integration Act, I think, was quite fairly characterized by the district court as having been passed in an atmosphere permeated with chauvinism.
Since when is it the function of the courts to inquire into the atmosphere in which the legislative branch acts?
Where the atmosphere is shown in specific testimony, specific statements.
Any case of our court, this court, that suggests that's a proper criterion?
I think that in the Arlington Heights case, where the question came up, starting if it's not clear on its face, we then look for congressional intent. Indeed, in this very statute, on the amendment that was considered in O'Brien, you look to whether there was any evidence of an improper intent. Now, in that case, of course, you found that there was none. In the case that's before you today, the clear testimony, the clear statements before Congress in 1948 to the effect that, well, no one would want a WAVE officer commanding him, that the men would object to being under the command of women, that women would get married and so never qualify for pensions. The entire atmosphere, and perhaps atmosphere was the wrong word for the district court to use, but the record is clear that there was nothing beyond stereotypical consideration
given at the time. If we disagree with the district court and with you that there ought to be the heightened scrutiny standard here and agree with the government that it should be just the rational basis test, can we affirm the judgment of the district court?
Yes, I believe you can.
How?
Particularly because the defense for the statute, even under the rational relationship test, is the military flexibility argument that the Solicitor General has described, and because that argument simply does not relate in any rational way to either the fact or the intent of the statute,
the function of the statute. If it's just a rational relationship, I would think unless you disbelieve that you could get as many women as you wanted or that were needed,
on a voluntary basis, it would be quite rational to decide not to go through the entire rigmarole of a registration and that drafting of women just to get the ones you could get without any expense whatsoever.
Well, in fact, there is no substantial basis in the record for believing that we can, with confidence, predict that we will be able to achieve.
Well, is there any basis for believing that we can't?
Yes.
In the record?
In the record, we have history to start with that in...
Well, what record are you talking about?
The record before the trial court and the record before Congress. There is great overlap between
what
the two.
What if we read the record different than you did and then thought that there was not only ample basis in the record, but a finding and evidence that you could get the women without registration? What then under the rational relationship test?
If it could be stated that we can safely predict that there would not arise a situation where volunteers would be inadequate, that would be a different situation. But that's not what we face at registration.
That's what I ask you. Would that satisfy the rational relationship test?
Yes. If we had a guarantee
yes,
that women would
yes.
not be needed, the answer is yes. And that goes, I think, to the very distinction between registration, which is insurance against failing to have volunteers and providing against the broad range of unpredictable futures which do confront us, and conscription, which is the decision when one of those futures becomes our present, to say these are what our needs are. We either have or don't have enough volunteers. We need to draft for certain positions.
And Mr. Weinberg, why isn't the rationality test, in light of the clauses of the Constitution we're dealing with, the proper test here?
All right. First of all, this Court, although often asked to, has never accepted a military relationship or national defense exception to normal standards of constitutional scrutiny.
What about Schlesinger and Ballard?
And Parker against Levy.
Parker, like Glines and Huff and Greer v. Spock, are so-called military enclave cases, and they all go off on Parker and Levy's language about the military being a separate society unto itself, internally requiring, for matters of discipline and base morale, a separate standard. This statute...
And we said there that the constitutional First Amendment overbreadth attack that was available in the non-military context was not available in the military context.
That's within a military enclave. This is not a military enclave case. This is more like Gillette. Indeed, I think that's the only situation where this particular act has been brought into question. And there, the Court required the government to show that the distinction drawn was strictly justified by substantial governmental interests relating directly. With Schlesinger and Ballard, there are a number of distinguishing characteristics.
That was within the military as well.
Pardon?
That was within the military as
that
well.
Was most directly within the military. It was an internal matter to the military where it was promotion geared to the military's expressed desire for the proper pyramid of promotions. Frontiero was also internal to the military.
What was the holding in Frontiero?
In Frontiero, the holding, I believe, was that the distinction drawn...
This was in the military.
It was definitely... It was within the military, but because it was the distinction drawn was based on stereotype, it failed a heightened scrutiny.
Failed heightened scrutiny.
Heightened scrutiny.
Not the rational relationship.
Definitely not the rational relationship test.
There was not a court opinion in Frontiero. Is that correct?
There was a plurality opinion in Frontiero.
So it's difficult to say.
But what was the fifth vote on based on?
The fifth vote was based... I believe, Your Honor, that the fifth vote was based upon an application of a test that went far beyond rational basis. It was, in effect, I think, a heightened scrutiny. Pardon? It was Reed, exactly.
Now what does Reed apply?
It's a heightened scrutiny, but of course...
the test is the test of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment as that is.
As it applies to gender, which was a close and substantial relationship.
It's the Constitution.
And Reed against Reed just says this court scrutinizes cases that are brought before it.
But looks for a substantial relationship, and that I think Craig v. Boren says that's what Reed says. Schlesinger's important for the ways in which it differs from this case. Every case, I think, in this court that has ever cited Schlesinger and purported to follow Schlesinger has emphasized that Schlesinger was a compensatory or ameliatory act. That, in fact, it was uniquely so because the very men who brought that act, who brought that action, were the precise men who had benefited from the assignment differential, which means access to promotion differential. And so that case really is perhaps the archetype of compensatory.
Like Kahn and Chevin?
Pardon?
Like Kahn and Chevin.
Like Kahn and Chevin. It is usually cited seriatim to Kahn and Chevin. The other thing is, of course, Schlesinger was an internal military case. And most importantly, as far as I can see, differentiating it between this case, other than the internal military matter, is that the basis of classification was not simply gender. The explicit basis of classification was gender, except where the access to the promotions was equal, at which point there was no differentiation. This court emphasized, I think, it at least three times in Schlesinger that where men and women, for instance, in the medical corps, the legal corps, several other corps, had equal access to assignments geared to foster promotions, there was no difference in the time permitted to achieve promotion. And that, I think, is very, very important. The other thing is that historically, Schlesinger was not based, even arguably, on stereotypes. It was demonstrably based upon a recent congressional reconsideration in 1967, in fact, of precisely what was going on. They found that there was still a gap in assignability, and there was still a gap, most particularly, in how long it was taking men and women to achieve promotions. And so Congress there did reenact, literally, as opposed to what happened here, major provisions of that entire series of statutes. So there really was congressional consideration there. That's not the case here.
Mr. Weinberg, before you, I see your light has gone on, before you sit down, I'd be interested in hearing what the other three of the 4 points are that we'll control.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the only one that didn't come out actually in the questioning is that in order to justify mail-only registration, the burden of the appellant at trial, and to prove that it was accomplished at trial here, was to prove a need to exclude women from registration.
Well, it seems to me you, maybe I'm out of step, but it seems to me you have the cart before the horse. I don't think, I have never understood that it was up to the government to justify an act of Congress. I had thought that an act of Congress is presumptively valid, and it's up to you to show why it's invalid.
Except where that act draws some form of,
well,
of discriminatory.
As the Solicitor General has pointed out, Congress here exercised one of its explicit powers under the Constitution, and with that you don't agree. You do agree.
And it was an assignment
and
under
I didn't understand the Solicitor General to suggest, and I hope he didn't suggest, that Congress, even in the exercise of an explicit power such as this, is not governed by the explicit prohibitions in the Constitution. And one of them is contained in the Fifth Amendment, and that's the one upon which you rely. And that's really the issue here. But the statute is presumptively valid, isn't it? Like any statute enacted by any legislature.
I think not. As this Court said as recently
there's
as
yesterday. There's no question of the power.
There's no question of the power.
And the question is that power limited or prohibited?
I would go one step further. As this Court has repeatedly said, when a legislature, including Congress, enacts a statute based upon gender, and the distinction of gender is on the face of the statute. It is based upon gender. It is the burden of those defending the statute to come forth and establish
well, perhaps,
by By empirical evidence, in fact.
Maybe the court has said that, but I trust I never have, because I don't think it's. I don't think they're defending a statute. I think you're attacking it.
But, Your Honor, once the attack shows that it was gender-based discrimination, this court, and I believe virtually every.
Doesn't the burden shift as soon as the government does, and you've conceded they've done here, show there's a difference in military need based on sex? You've conceded that's permissible.
Your Honor, that would affect registration only if two different statutes were involved. One, a statutory prohibition on women participating in certain close combat activities, and the other, more importantly, a change in the Military Selective Service Act limiting the induction of people to people who will be assigned to those prohibited roles, because otherwise we are conflicting with history, and Congress did not mean to conflict with history, because we have always, and the testimony of General Tice and all the generals is clear, we have always drafted a very substantial, indeed often a majority of draftees, specifically for the non-combat areas. And most importantly, the argument of flexibility was specifically refuted by General Abrams and other generals in the testimony, because we are saying that there is a certain number of women that the military wants to have, welcomes, thinks is the optimal number for the defense of the country. You cannot at the one point say that that is the military opinion and at the same time say that if those spots are filled with draftees rather than volunteers, we undermine flexibility. The testimony of every Defense Department witness and every military witness was that all of those criteria, the reach back, the flexibility, the rotation, the promotion rotation, the assignment rotation, were all taken fully into account when the military said, please let us register women and let us decide whether they should be drafted if and when the time for a draft comes. General Abrams said that he didn't favor drafting women at the time because he didn't favor drafting men at the time. They were in an all-volunteer mode, as he said. And that since present needs of both men and women were being met with volunteers, he didn't favor drafting anybody at that time. Secretary Brown kept saying to Congress, let us register people now. And then, when we see what the need is, we can draft them. This was what we came within a hair's breadth of doing in World War II with respect to nurses. I would only point out that the utilization question is contrary to what the government says. For example, ministers are required to be.
I would ask if the case would be different in constitutional terms if the military had taken the position, we don't like women, we don't want any of them in the army. Would it be a different constitutional issue?
It would be a different matter of somehow meeting an evidentiary burden.
Which they might have said in 1948, by the way.
They didn't. As a matter of fact, General Eisenhower's statement to the Congress in 1948 was, if we ever have another war, we have got to draft women. And that was based upon their performance, even in the more limited numbers and roles that we used them in World War II. I would point out that
Mr. Weinberg, you have emphasized the testimony, and I quite agree with you. If I were in your place, I would. Of some of the military men, I think you can find conflicting statements if you read it all. But what I want to ask you is this. The Armed Services Committee of the United States Senate, by a vote of 12-5, reached an entirely different result from the one that you reached, and they heard the testimony, not only this year, but they've been hearing it for years. Now, did the district court reject specifically a single one of the 11 findings made by the Senate Armed Services Committee that were in turn approved by the conferees of both houses and in turn by both houses of Congress?
Yes, I think the district court specifically rejected
all,
a number
all
of
11,
them.
All 11? And if so, do we accept the rejection by the district court, the tribal lawsuit, that was contrary to the findings of the United States Congress?
When we can read the testimony as well as the district judge could read it.
And if so, what authority justifies us in doing that?
Perhaps the Castle opinion handed down this morning.
I have not had the opportunity to read that. The treatment of what happened in 1980 as congressional action was, the conference report said that there was no need to include women. It did not find an affirmative need to exclude women. Again, Congress was dealing, I think, with the wrong question in that respect. More importantly, perhaps, the activity of Congress in 1980 was not a reenactment or reconsideration of this situation. The appropriations aspect of it, the House joint resolution, didn't even mention the word registration. It was a transfer of otherwise unobligated funds from the Air Force to Selective Service for the purpose of salaries and expenses. I think ex parte endo, with its requirement for explicit mention of a particular expenditure rationale, says that that would not suffice. Now, with respect to S-2294, the Authorizations Act, again,
I think you're going beyond Justice Powell's question now, and your time has expired, unless Justice Powell wishes to
press.
Yes, your time has expired. The case is submitted, gentlemen. Thank you very much. We'll hear our